Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute, on air and online, this is Intersection.
Hello and welcome to Intersection, where people and ideas meet. Back in the day, elections seemed so simple. You watched one of the three major news network night newscasts each night. You read one or two major newspapers in your area every day. You maybe listened to the radio. And then you made a decision and you went to the polls. It's a bit simplistic, I know, but I'm going to make a point here. Nowadays, there are multiple TV networks pumping out news around the clock, an endless stream of political articles and blog entries posted to the web, and an entire world of social media swirling around that. Add to it the new army of fact-checkers and an unprecedented amount of political advertising, and it begs a simple question. Is it just me, or is democracy getting more difficult? There's a lot more information to be had from a lot more different sources, but how effective is all this extra journalism when it comes to helping voters like you? Against all the political advertising and sophisticated campaign machines, does the news do enough to help you make good decisions? And if not, what should news providers be doing? Our guests today are going to help us look at the present and future of news media in our democracy. First, Dan Gilmore is the director of the Knight Center for Digital Media Entrepreneurship at Arizona State University. He's an internationally recognized author whose expertise includes media entrepreneurship and citizen-based journalism. Welcome to our program, Dan Gilmore.
I'm glad to be with you.
Glad to have you with us as well. For those of you in our audience, just so you know, Dan is going to be speaking tonight at 7 p.m. at the Reynolds Journalism Institute on the MU campus. That event is free and open to the public, and that's part of why we were able to have him here with us today. So thanks for taking time.
I thank you for the promo.
Glad to help out with that. We also have on the phone from Washington, D.C., Andrea Seabrook. She previously covered Congress for National Public Radio, but earlier this year she struck out on her own to start a podcast and blog called Decode D.C. Welcome to our program, Andrea Seabrook.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Glad to have you with us by phone. We hope that those of you in our audience will join our conversation as well. Do you think it's gotten easier or harder to figure out which way to vote in elections? And why do you think that is? Give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. And let's start with this question. Andrea, I want to start with you. What's it like covering Congress? I mean, what sort of information are you able to get and provide to people that you think is helpful?
Well, covering Congress is really hard. It's an incredibly Byzantine system, not only of governance, but just the Capitol itself. So you spend a couple of years sort of, you know, figuring out the proverbial where the bathroom is, but also, you know, learning how to find lawmakers if you need to talk to them about, you know, particular policy, trying to figure out who is against whom and what the political allegiances are on both sides and who is a rising star, and all of those things matter in the Capitol. And then I got to a point about a year and a half to 2 years in covering Congress where I started to realize that everything that I saw going on in front of me wasn't actually what the real story was, that journalists in the Capitol, you know, will get a press release saying it'll be a leader of one party or another saying, we're going to have a press conference in this place at this time, and everybody shows up. And everybody, you know, records what those lawmakers say and then plays it back on their TV or radio stations or prints it in the newspaper. And given that politics, their political journalism now works that way, the lawmakers have become very sophisticated about only saying the message that they want repeated in the media. And I ended up feeling like it made me a mouthpiece for all of the problems rather than part of the solution.
Right. And what gets in the way of journalists not becoming that? I mean, why, Andrea or Dan, why is it that, you know, there's this sense of being a mouthpiece as opposed to doing something else?
I think it may be harder for broadcast people to avoid that at some level because people's voices are part of what they do, and you use their voices, and the time is much more limited. There's no excuse, in my opinion, for people with longer form print and other to be stenographers. Yet, that's what Washington journalism has effectively become. And well-paid stenography so that you can stay in the club has never struck me as a particularly useful form of journalism.
Right. Andrea, from your experience, I mean, has it always been that way, or did something shift?
Well, you know, I was in the Capitol for about 10 years, and I know that things, you know, Washington has always been a town about politics, and that's true. I think it's harder now for journalists to take the time that it takes to report on these things in a different way. I also think news organizations are trying to do more coverage with less money and fewer journalists so that we as journalists are forced to just, you know, the news becomes what happened today. And when all you're doing is reporting what happened today, then all you are doing is recording the soundbite of one side and the soundbite of another and playing both of them back on All Things Considered. And I just felt like with our audience, the NPR audience is so bright and so engaged, and I just decided that I couldn't treat them that way anymore. But, you know, and to be fair, NPR is a great news organization, and I love NPR. It's just that with the amount of money NPR has, they sort of can't decide one day, well, one of our congressional reporters is not going to cover the news as it happens every day anymore. She's going to define it differently. And so I decided I had to leave to do it.
Right. Well, let's talk about that. I mean, isn't there some value in reporting what people in political office are saying from day to day?
Absolutely. Absolutely there is. Only if the journalist is able to unpack it and put it in the context that it is in. And that context is that politics is valued above most everything in Washington, including problem solving and policy. And almost every statement that politicians make in Washington is gamed out for its effect on one party or the other. If you don't give it that context, then it can appear to be an actual statement about policy or issues or, you know, ethics or morals, when in fact most of the time that's not what's going on.
Okay.
There's a further context that seems necessary to me, which is that a lot of what people say in politics is false, is, you know, they're lying. And it seems to me that journalists have an obligation, which they don't fulfill much of the time, when they get two quotes, one that are kind of polar opposites, one of which is true and the other of which is false. I think they ought to tell us that one of them is true and one of them is false, because if they're not doing that, they're not doing their jobs.
Okay, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the changing media landscape and how well it helps you make a decision as a voter. Joining me in the studio is Dan Gilmore, director of the Knight Center for Digital Media Entrepreneurship at Arizona State University. And joining us by phone is Andrea Seabrook, a former congressional reporter for NPR, who is now producing an independent podcast and blog called Decode DC. For those of you in our audience, what information do you use to make up your mind when it comes to voting? Give us a call. Share your experience. Our number is 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. And we'd like to remind you that Intersection is broadcast live every Monday at 2 on KBIA and online at kbia.org. You can be part of our conversation at that time and watch our video stream by going to kbia.org and following the link for Intersection. Andrea, how hard is it for a journalist to tell a politician you're lying? I mean, some people were upset that Jim Lehrer did not do that during the presidential debates last week. How easy or hard is that for a journalist to actually add that kind of context?
You know, I would say that the problem is not that they can't tell the journalist they're lying. Maybe on TV or if they're, you know, hosting a debate, that it's a different story. It's harder for the journalist to tell the readers that that the lawmaker or the politician is lying. And that's because many news organizations have been cowed by the charges of imbalance, of being biased. Some organizations bend over backwards to show that they aren't biased, to the point of not of creating a false equivalency of two sides of an argument. This is exactly what Dan was talking about. When the media says, well, there are two opinions on global warming. It's real and that it's not real. Then the media is in fact legitimizing an opinion which is completely untrue, and that is that global warming isn't a real phenomenon and you know shouldn't be taken care of. And the same thing is true about many other issues. And that in itself is a reaction by the news organization to being called biased. And I feel like there's some bullying that has happened that news organizations have been subject to, and they've got to be stronger than that.
Right. Dan, what about all this fact-checking we're seeing? I mean, isn't that in a way a journalism organization saying, hey, politician, that's not true?
Well, call me old-fashioned, but I kind of hope journalists would do the fact-checking as they're doing the journalism. I realize that's a novel concept at this point, but and I don't mean to be too rough on journalists. I spent a long time in the business, and I understand that deadline pressures are difficult, but there's a certain amount of passing it off to fact-checkers that I think is a real mistake. And the other issue with fact-checkers that is very problematic, I don't think that they get more than about one strike before I don't believe anything they say, especially when, in the case of several prominent fact-checkers, they've made mistakes but not owned up to them. At that point, I say, well, I don't know what I can trust from you. I love fact-checking. I love the idea that people are doing more of it, but it's a problematic exercise that, in the end, is going to come back to the audience to do more due diligence on their own at some level.
Mm-hmm. Andrew, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think the fact that fact-checkers need to exist is already a failure of the journalism that has happened. I mean, I can only speak to my own decisions in my career, but, you know, I decided that I am not going to go to press conferences and report them as news anymore. I may record a press conference, but, if you report what happens at a press conference on the day that it happens, then you have no time to tell your audience the context or the truthfulness of anything that is said to you. And so you have to step outside of the need to report things immediately in favor of providing what I think is a real service to listeners, telling them, you know, the context of the comments and what they can trust about it and what they can't. I mean, the reason journalists are here, right, is to do some of this work for the listeners, and it's the reason why the listeners would want the journalists in the first place.
Well, let's talk.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, you mentioned kind of an important phrase there, what the journalists are here to do. And I wonder from Dan, we're going to start with you on this. What exactly is the journalist supposed to be doing?
Well, it depends in so many ways on what role the journalist has assumed, what topic they're doing, where they are in the world. And if we're talking about politics, I think the journalist role ought to be, and this is, again, easy for me to say from a distance, ought to be less about process and less about, who's up or who's down at the moment, and more about the issues that they're talking about and the issues surrounding whether people get to vote. I mean, as an example, the most important process story in a decade or more is the fact that there is an active voter suppression campaign underway to prevent certain groups from voting this fall. Yet you can barely get journalists to pay attention to that, because if they do, they're going to be accused of bias by one side. This is a kind of thing that just puzzles me, and I'd like to see more attention to the things that we're actually going to vote about as opposed to the people we're going to vote for.
Mm-hmm. Andrew, your thoughts on that?
I believe that as a journalist, I have to begin to report more on the theater of what's happening around around political office and governance in our country. That telling people what a politician said today is not actually the news, but instead reporting on the way the system is skewed against real political dialogue. It actually helps people make better decisions. For example, the first episode of Decode DC, my new show, is called The House of Misrepresentatives. And it's about all the ways in which the House of Representatives is a very poor representation of the American people and the consequences of that for how those representatives actually do the work of representing the nation. That gives, I hope that gives listeners tools for making judgments about their own lawmaker and about the laws and understanding better the morass we're in Congress.
Yeah, but I mean, couldn't somebody do the exact same program about how journalists are not necessarily representative of the mass of American listeners or viewers?
Sure, but journalists aren't elected representatives of the American people. That's not their purpose. It may be what you want in your journalist, and you're free to seek out the journalism of people that you think represent you accurately, or you can read anyone's, work, and not someone else's. But when it comes to the House of Representatives, the House of Representatives was supposed to be the body in government that is closest to the people, and 44% of the House of Representatives are millionaires or better, and 17% are women. So that has a real effect on what those people, how they see the world that they live in, and what they think the government needs to do.
Right.
And expanding on Andrea's point, the not only are journalists unelected, which seems to bother some people, but there's absolutely no barrier to entry anymore into the media profession or craft. So if you don't think one group or bunch of groups is doing the job properly, it doesn't take a lot of resources anymore to try it yourself. So I think we should, actually I'd like to see more people doing more kinds of media, and we're seeing that develop.
Well, let's talk about that for a second, because that is one of the things that has changed over the years, is now there you can get information practically anywhere these days, right? It used to be that there were trusted journalists that you believed were working on your behalf as a reader or viewer or audience member. And now there's so many places that a lot of people might not even know where to go. And you're encouraging more of that.
Well, I would question one part of that first part of what you said.
Mm-hmm.
There, when you said there were trusted journalists, there were some. But we really had not much of an alternative about the journalism that we either chose to trust or not. And I think over the years, the oligopoly, monopoly system of journalism that we had in the last century engendered a lot of distrust from a lot of people on all parts of the political spectrum. And anyone who's ever been covered knows perfectly well how flawed journalism actually is. So it's an interesting thing. I don't think that it's not that we're going to get all kinds of new perfection, because we're not. But we're going to the variety, the actual marketplace of ideas, as opposed to that stunted one of the past, strikes me as better in the long run for getting a lot of high quality stuff. Then the problem becomes, as you're pointing out, to sort it out.
Right. Okay. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the changing media landscape and how it fits with our changing democracy. Joining me in the studio is Dan Gilmore, director of the Knight Center for Digital Media Entrepreneurship at Arizona State University. And joining us by phone is Andrea Seabrook, a former congressional reporter for NPR, who now produces an independent podcast and blog called Decode DC. For those of you in our audience, when it comes to political coverage, what do you wish the journalists would do that maybe they don't? Share your ideas. Give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. I want to just kind of on that note, there was an article that came out in the New York Times about this fact-checking stuff after the Republican convention, after Paul Ryan gave his speech that sent fact-checkers into, a flurry of activity. And I just want to read a paragraph out of this. It says, It's two paragraphs here, actually. The increasingly disaggregated media ecosystem, the diminished trust in traditional news organizations, and the rise of social media had made it easier than ever to inject questionable assertions directly into the media bloodstream and, of course, to rebut them. But while there is arguably more fact-checking now than ever, and thanks to the web, more ways to independently check what candidates and campaigns say, verdicts that a campaign has crossed the line are often drowned out by dissent from its supporters, who take it upon themselves to check the checkers. So what this New York Times article is sort of describing is this mass proliferation of people putting forth their ideas, kind of what you described. But it gets to a place where there's so much going on out there that it's hard to tell, okay, what of all of this should I believe? And so, Dan, I want to ask you that question. For the typical voter, you know, there's a lot of places they can go and sort of process a lot of this information. How do they sort through all that?
Well, two things. One is that the assertion that there's more fact-checking, I think, is false. There's a lot more after-the-fact checking going on now. And that's not an original line for me. It's from a brilliant writer named Clay Shirky, whose work everyone here should read. The other point is that we're in this new ecosystem that's developing is going to require more of us as audience than the one that we had in the past.
So you're saying democracy is getting harder?
I don't think it's getting – I don't think that means it's getting harder. I would say it's getting more interesting. and it means we have to do more at some level. But we're going to have to find sources that we trust in more – it's going to take a little bit more effort at the beginning, and over time we're going to be developing better tools that will combine human and machine intelligence for recommendations and all kinds of cool stuff. But yes, we're going to have to pay a little more attention and find things that we can trust. And very importantly, at the same time, we're going to – very much need to go outside of our personal zones of comfort and make sure that we look at things that we know are going to make our blood boil, just to be sure that we aren't missing important things at the same time. I learn more from people who think I'm wrong than from people who think I'm right.
Interesting.
Yeah, I believe that we're developing a sophisticated new antenna in this country. I think the younger generation has grown it better than I have and better than my parents have, although we all work on it. And I think that Americans intuitively understand that politics and the way the government is chosen and operates is broken. It's not, you know, sort of dysfunctional or on its way. It's broken. And they crave a kind of journalism that explains how it got that way and what we can do about it. But instead, the media, especially those of us in Washington, are in forever gaming out everything that happens in Washington for how it affects one party or the other and their reelection in the next cycle. And I think it takes a certain amount of reevaluating the news landscape, making a decision about what people need from journalism, and taking bold steps in that direction.
So, Andrea, are you saying that most people are like Dan, that they want to read stuff that makes their blood boil? Or because that's not my sense of things. My sense is that, you know, a lot of people who watch Fox News, for example, watch Fox News because they like the worldview that that presents. And same with a lot of the people who watch MSNBC. They like, you know, having news that kind of fits with the way they see the world. NPR listeners, probably the same thing, right?
I think that the political process right now and the media going along, I don't mean going along with it, but the way that the pressures that are on media outlets has made it incredibly easy for people to only listen to things that they already believe in. I think it serves the purposes of the political parties themselves to convince Americans that they're on two teams, that each issue can be divided into a red issue and a blue issue, that all points of view and solutions are either red or blue, and that you are fundamentally different from your neighbor because he's a Democrat or, you know, he's a Republican. And that is not serving our citizens at all. It is serving the politicians themselves. And I think that's what I mean by the new, more sophisticated antenna. Americans have got to figure out that they're being played when they decide that one party has all the answers and one news channel or one media outlet.
But isn't that a bit of a hard sell? I mean, isn't that sort of like asking a Missouri fan to stop cheering for their team and instead, I don't know, just like hope for a compelling game, whatever the outcome is?
I think it will be a more compelling argument as the parties continue to not represent the interests of the people in it. I mean, for people who are conservatives, I ask them, okay, Republicans had the House, the Senate, and the White House for much of the early part of the last decade, and did you see any movement at all on abortion? Did you see the size of government get rolled back? Did you see, you know, reductions in debt and deficit? You know, what happens once people get into office is not what they were elected to do. And the same thing happens on the Democratic side. You know, this fealty that people show to the one political party or the other doesn't ultimately make sense.
Right. Dan, your thoughts on that question of sort of team mentality and how to address that?
Well, I think part of it is the idea that we're on teams politically is it misconstrues what the republic should be about at a pretty fundamental level. And while I understand that increasingly in Washington the word compromise is a four-letter word, it's actually how things get done or how things have gotten done. And I think the evidence in the history of this republic is that at the times when there were parties and of all kinds compromising and getting things done, that the republic was doing better than in the last few years where no compromise has been possible. And that we'll see what happens. But I when you say it's like I don't think it's at all like rooting for a great game, because the idea of I think politics being some kind of game is that worries me. This is much more serious than no matter how much you love the football team, the consequences of them losing are not meaningful compared to the consequences of gridlock or worse in Washington.
Well, Dan, what about the skirmishes that are taking place over some basic facts in the political discourse? I mean, there are things we can't even agree on, whether those are numbers or outcomes or those things that, you know, might seem potentially factual, but we can't agree on that.
Well, you know, people, there's a long and rich history in America of people believing stuff that's not true. So we came out of that okay. What worries me is when people deny things like science and say, well, science is false, and that becomes policy. If it's something widely believed but not policy, I'm fine with that.
Right. Okay. I just want to let everyone – just, Andrea, I have to stop us, unfortunately. We've got to go into a break. This is Intersection, a program of RJI and KBIA. Today we're talking about the present and future of the news media as a democratic institution. Joining me in the studio is Dan Gilmore, the director of the Knight Center for Digital Media Entrepreneurship at Arizona State University. Joining us by phone, Andrea Seabrook, former congressional reporter for NPR and now producer of the podcast Decode DC. We'll be right back. We hope you'll stick around after this. And welcome back. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the present and future of the news media as a democratic institution. Joining me in the studio is Dan Gilmore, director of the Knight Center for Digital Media Entrepreneurship at Arizona State University. And joining us by phone is Andrea Seabrook, a former congressional reporter for NPR and now producer of the independent podcast and blog Decode DC. For those of you in our audience, what might you change if you got to be in charge of the news media? I'd love to hear your ideas. So give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. We have a caller who's been waiting on the line patiently, and I'd like to bring her into the conversation. Christy, are you with us?
Yes.
Great. Thanks for joining the program today and for calling in.
You're welcome.
So you were going to talk about how you make your decision to vote. Is that right?
Well, either one. You had asked a couple different questions.
Okay. Well, fire away.
Okay, well, as far as the way I make my decisions to vote, I actually avoid a lot of the news media and stuff for these very reasons that Andrea mentioned, that it's so, you know, what happened exactly today, what they did, or, you know, all the sound bites and things. And so what I have done over the last 20 years or so of voting is look at American history and basically look at, will develop principles that I think are reflected in effective government, you know. And so I just sort of developed a list, and then I take the issues or the candidate and how well they match up, you know. I mean, is this issue going more towards effective government or farther away from effective government as I see it? You know, of course, that's a personal thing, but That's how I vote. You know, so I really try to stay away from the candidates' websites or the, you know, just the day-to-day reporting because of these issues that you guys have been discussing, the problems.
Right. And just out of curiosity, I mean, where, in terms of evaluating the, you know, the candidates or the way things are going against your view of that, I mean, are you're getting information from somewhere?
History.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you know, just studying American history and the different decisions and, you know, was this a decision that led to a greater amount of freedom and opportunity for a greater amount of people, you know, the greater amount, or is it something that's taking away freedom? You know, in my opinion, American history, or in America, the greatest thing about it is the freedom that it gives and the mm-hmm. opportunity for people, for all the different people. You know, and of course, it hasn't been perfect, but I feel like in overall, we've slowly moved, sort of ever moving more and more towards that, you know, for the most part. Mm-hmm. And so I just look at legislation or candidates or whatever and see, you know, are they giving more freedom to people and opportunity and this kind of thing or less, you know.
Mm-hmm. And do you have any recommendations for the journalists?
This will probably never happen, except indirectly, like, because like Dan was saying, we need more choice and, you know, and places for people to go. But I personally feel like journalists, I would love to just hear a journalist say, hey, you know, this is my personal bias, and then here's my report if you want to listen to it. You know, just because I feel like just by nature, human beings, you know, just have personal bias. I mean, just what you think is newsworthy, you know, when you're looking at the day, what you consider to be newsworthy, in my opinion, is informed by personal biases, you know, on whatever side you want to say it's on. And so I just feel like it'd be kind of nice to go, hey, here's my personal bias, and if you agree with that, you can, you know, read my blog or my report or whatever.
Well, Christy, thank you so much for calling in today and being part of our conversation.
You're welcome.
I want to give our panel a chance to respond to that. Andrea, what would that be like if journalists tried to do what Christy just suggested and said, hey, here's what I think, here's what I believe in, read my report if you want to?
I think you might be surprised. I think the people who there are an awful lot of people who do that already. You could look at, you know, they're great journalists. Rachel Maddow on MSNBC is not scared of saying what she believes. Fox News is not scared of being, you know, saying what they believe. It's funny. What I think might be surprising is that I already do in my journalism say what I believe. The longer I was in the Capitol, the less I felt any affiliation with any political party or even the issues that they talk about, because I realized that what is so much more important as a, and has a much greater effect on our country and how it operates is the fact that lawmakers often spend hours and hours a day raising money for their reelection campaigns. And so I am, you know, I barely think about party or issue anymore that you would, you know, that, that people, citizens who don't spend their time in the Capitol think about, you know, abortion, education, any of that, because I see the a greater problem than any of those, for example.
Right. Dan, your thoughts on that?
Well, I'm in favor of certainly a lot more transparency in journalism than we have. I don't go as far on that as some of my friends who are into the not quite this far, but publish our tax returns online thing. I would stop with that. But I think journalists in general ought to do more of explaining what the worldview of their organization is. And organizations do have worldviews. That's simply true. And in the UK, for example, the Guardian is center left, the Telegraph center right, both very fine newspapers doing very fine journalism, but they are proud of their worldviews, and you can refract that through a lens and get kind of what's going on. We don't do that much here. Bloggers are much more likely to be transparent about what they believe and what they think should be happening. And I think in general, that's better if you have a bias to say what it is. It doesn't reduce the need for journalism that tries to capture as many sides of issues as possible. I think we need a lot more of that. But the worldview is important. There are other ways of being transparent about, like, why are you covering this? What's the what made you decide to cover this story and not that one? I'd like to hear more of that. How did you go about covering a story? I'd like to hear more about that sometimes. Mm-hmm. Lots of ways to do it. In general, I think that would improve journalism a lot if we did that.
Right. And you think the average reader has the capacity, wants that and wants to add that to the repertoire of what they're trying to take in? Because, I mean, people have a limited amount of time to consume news, and we're trying to give them news, and now we're going to add on a layer of, and here's why we did what we did.
Not everybody, of course, but for those who are interested, I think it would create more trust. If journalists were more transparent, I think they'd be trusted more, even if they would be probably believed a little bit less in any individual fact.
So talk a little bit more about that difference between trust and being believed, because aren't they the same thing?
No. The belief means I'm thinking of belief in the sense of, do I believe everything I read here? Mm-hmm. Anyone who's been in journalism knows that we make lots of mistakes. However, we're not very transparent about that. So when I say transparency about, in particular, about mistakes and about things that are missing, would create on the part of the audience a bit more trust, even if the audience would recognize that it was less likely that everything was true in the piece, as long as you corrected it as quickly as you could. So I think belief and trust are different in this context.
Interesting. Andrea, your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that's absolutely true. I think there are a lot of journalists that I read that I don't subscribe to their worldview, as Dan is saying, but I do find that their journalism and their information is very, very good. I think the caller that called in before has a really interesting and smart way of dealing with politics, and that is to sort of decide what her worldview is, and then try and take an objective look herself at the candidates without buying the line of the candidate or the party that is marketing that candidate. I think these are really interesting ways that people can sort of inoculate themselves as much as is possible from the spin and really take a good look at what they believe. Because the truth is, you get what you vote for. And if you vote for a person who is very believes in your ideology, but to the point of never compromising with the other side, then what you are voting for is gridlock.
All right. Dan, go ahead.
I want to emphasize what Andrea said about the caller, who I thought was making very interesting points about how she looks at the world and how she makes a decision. Her voting, as I understood what she was saying, is strategic, not tactical. That she has, you know, a strategy in mind she would like to see the Republic move toward, which is more freedom. I don't know exactly how she defines that, but I really liked that notion that she has a holistic, strategic view of politics, and that her voting is designed to enhance that. And I think in general we do that in our voting, but I thought she put it in a particularly interesting way.
Mm-hmm. There's a comment that came up in our chat room that, you know, we talk about evaluating media sources here. The question from the chat room is, this person says, I'm interested in whether Dan or Andrea have news organizations that they follow as consumers. What news venues get it right for them? Andrea, where do you get political news that you think, you know, is up to snuff?
Well, I'm very lucky in that I get a lot of primary sources. I mean, I talk to the, you know, lawmakers and politicians themselves, and that's helpful. I tend to read a lot of really boring things that other people wouldn't want to, like actual reports from the Government Accountability Office and things like that. The good thing is, for those people who do want to read those things, they're out there now. You can read them on the Internet, and it helps to have access to primary sources. On the other hand, you know, I mean, truly, I spend a lot of time reading everything I can find on one issue. So in that way, I tend to look at Google News or Real Clear Politics, which is a website that aggregates political news, or, you know, those are my go-to, and whatever anyone has published about an issue, the fiscal cliff or whatever, I will read from the Wall Street Journal and, you know, the Fox News webpage all the way to Mother Jones and, you know, what the Green Party has issued a press release about. I'm interested in the entire landscape of an issue. Right.
And I'm going to guess you have a little more time for that than a lot of people might.
Yes, it is. It is, in fact, what I do every day.
Dan, what about you?
Well, your point was really well taken about most people are you know, have a life to live and beyond scouting around on the internet for interesting stuff, and we in the business tend to forget that at times. Yeah. But that's an occupational hazard. I have, you know, enormous number of things that I read. Increasingly, decreasingly, I guess, I go to news organizations' homepages. There are a few I still check every day. But increasingly, I'm getting a lot of what I need from people who follow topic areas and who have become effectively my editors in those areas. And I try to make sure that they're going to give me a variety from political and other perspectives. So the aggregation and curation part of journalism strikes me as such a big, big part of the future, and I get this from a lot of different people, and I don't think I'm less informed. I think I'm actually better informed today.
And is that through news sources, or is that through your Facebook account and your Twitter account? Or, I mean, where exactly are you finding these people who are doing this for you?
Well, some of it I set up myself through easy topic searches and keyword searches that I save. Some of it is on Twitter. Twitter is actually becoming quite a good early warning system for many topics. I have my concerns about Twitter and its ecosystem, but I love using it. Google Plus has become valuable. Facebook, less so for me because I don't use it much. Mm-hmm. But a number of other places and a number of other aggregation sources that, as Andrea mentioned, that are quite valuable. But we're keep in mind, we're at the early days of the development of these tools, and no one has come close to getting this right so that we as individuals and as communities of geography or interest can actually sort the really good stuff from all of the other stuff.
Right. I want to read a comment that came in via email from one of our audience members, Jessica, and I want to get you to respond to this, Dan. This is the comment. I believe that we should have more independent media taking a more grassroots approach at informing the masses. In the really old days, people would send newsletters and pamphlets through the post to inform people of happenings, especially questionable behavior in our society and government. I've ruled out anything that is broadcast by mainstream media because either side, liberal or conservative, are owned by major corporations and they control what we see and how we understand what's really happening. There needs to be a media revolution. Again, that was an email from one of our audience members, Jessica. Dan, your thoughts on that? A more independent media creating a media revolution?
Well, what she said, yes. I'd add to that a little bit. Her first comment, though, about getting it to the masses, I'm sure because of what followed that she understands that there's a contradiction there, that when we're sending newsletters out to a small group of people, we're not sending anything to the masses. But she's onto something important, which is that we are able to inform each other and through various means find out about information of interest to smaller kinds of communities that add up to the masses. But I think she's right to be skeptical of anything from big media. It's not when I say be skeptical, it doesn't mean don't believe anything. Be skeptical of everything, but use judgment. And if she wants to worry about big media consolidation, there's a much bigger problem that's coming along, which is the telecom carriers and so-called broadband providers are increasingly going to be taking control of the media we can use and send. That worries me a lot.
Right.
And I'd like to point out
please
that,
do, yeah.
Yeah, that one of the reasons why NPR and stations like this one are so important is because they're the last places where the profit motive of big organizations and having to push advertising hasn't skewed the journalistic motive of their news. And for that reason, when I left NPR, which I wholly believe in, the NPR model of a lot of people giving a little bit of money, and the people giving the money are the actual consumers of the content, then, you know, I left, and we're running a Kickstarter campaign right now online, which is trying to raise money online for seed money for my show, Decode DC. And, you know, that's the same kind of business model where I'm asking for a little bit of money from a lot of people instead of trying to get them to watch a toothpaste commercial so the toothpaste company can give me money to produce my show, because then suddenly it becomes more important that my listeners see the toothpaste commercial than that they see the content that, you know, that I'm actually producing. So that model, that NPR model, I think is very viable in the future, and you're seeing organizations like ProPublica and the Center for Political Integrity in Politics and other nonprofit news organizations are doing great work because they don't overlay a profit motive on it.
And how's that going for you, the Kickstarter campaign?
It's going really well. We're over a third of the way there, and we have 11 days left. And a lot of people, you know, people who believe in a redefinition of the news, hitting the reset button here, have been kicking in anywhere from $1 to $5,000 at Kickstarter.com. You just look for Decode DC. And you know, especially what has helped is we have a couple of episodes of the show out, and those are at decodedc.com, and people are hungry for a different kind of news.
This is one of the great things that's happening. The barrier to entry is low in terms of the cost of creating media. It's down to almost zero. And now we're seeing fundamentally democratized ways of supporting the media that we want to have. And so Andrea's Kickstarter campaign is one. There are lots of interesting and innovative ideas in business models. I am personally in favor of a for-profit model because I think nothing is as relentless in making you do your job right as having customers. I like that. But I also believe we should try everything. Not-for-profit is a different kind of business, but it's a great kind of business. Co-op journalism is starting to make some inroads in this country. I want to see all of these things happen. And so I'm delighted to see what Andrea is doing and many others.
Right. Let me remind everyone that this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about news coverage of politics now and in the future. Joining me in the studio is Dan Gilmore, director of the Knight Center for Digital Media Entrepreneurship at Arizona State University. And joining us by phone is Andrea Seabrook, a former congressional reporter for NPR, now producer of the independent podcast and blog Decode DC. For those of you in our audience, you have a few minutes left to join our conversation. Feel free to call in with your thoughts or your questions. Our phone number is 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. I want to get to one more thing that came through our online chat room, which if you go to kbia.org, follow the link for Intersection, you can get to that. We were talking about, you know, this idea of lots of independent organizations potentially being funded by people who believe in their mission. This comment goes back a little before we started talking about that, but it sort of ties together. But the comment is, wouldn't a transparent, biased journalism field perpetuate an extreme polarity Congress is already showing? And I want to tie these two things together. I want to get to that question and also this idea of news organizations following that kind of NPR funding model may or may not be likely to get funding from people that don't agree with their worldview, right? So all of that together, I think, kind of gets at this question that the listener is asking. Wouldn't a transparent, biased journalism field not help the situation of the team mentality we were talking about earlier in the program? Dan, I want to start with you on that, and then we'll hear Andrea's thoughts.
I think it could well do that if the audience for journalism chooses not to care and chooses to not exercise judgment and chooses not to look for ideas and facts that may be contrary to the things they believe. I think the consequences of us doing that are pretty horrific, but I think this becomes part of a media literacy that we've kind of let run, go fallow in the last 50 years that we have to restore. And it's one of the things I work on. But it's not going to be simple and not going to be easy to do, though I think it's essential. Otherwise, we're going to just talk past each other. And again, I'll just stress this, is that we will only learn if we make sure to look at things we are unlikely to agree with.
All right. Andrea, your thoughts?
Well, I couldn't agree more. I absolutely agree that the key to all of this ultimately is education. And that's a key to a lot of problems that we have in our country right now. People who are less educated are less savvy about the world that we live in right now, which is an incredibly branded, marketed world. They're less able to inoculate themselves from being manipulated by the messages both of politicians and commercial fundraisers and corporations and those messages are increasingly sophisticated. I think, though, as Dan said earlier, my response to the question of shouldn't we watch out for, you know, this kind of media or that kind of media and what it might do, I think everything has to be tried right now. I want to see it all. I want to see more journalists take a bold step and go forward and try a different definition of news. I want to see everybody out there trying to figure out what is going on in this landscape in our country.
Mm-hmm. In terms of new ideas and experiments, I mean, Decode DC is an attempt to do something different, right?
Yes.
What exactly is it that you think needs to be done that has not been tried yet?
I am trying to start, like I said a little bit ago, start with the point of view that Washington is a broken set of broken processes. And so my reporting is not about which side is right about which issue or even what the two sides think about anything, but more how the place got broken in the first place and what happens now from here. That is the news that I think people need more than anything right now, because coloring every single issue in the world as either, you know, a Democratic or a Republican issue is beside the point when the actual process of Democratic and Republican is the thing that's broken. You know, it's kind of like, you know, something people who are ill cough up germs. You know, I think it's more important to step back and give context to the whole process and the whole system at this point so that people can figure out how to move forward.
Right. I mean, what I've been hearing both of you say is that people need to start listening to the stuff they don't agree with a little more. I mean, that seems like one clear directive of what this conversation is getting at.
It would be a good start.
Well, Andrew, I do a fair amount of that, yes.
Right. Dan, your thoughts on this question of what needs to happen differently in terms of the media? You mentioned news co-ops. What is a news co-op, first of all?
Well, anyone who's ever shopped at a food co-op knows what a co-op is. Any farmer who's a member of a grain co-op has knowledge of it. Essentially, it's owned by its users. And in a co-op, for a food co-op, you either contribute your work or you pay a little more, a membership fee, to buy things that are what you assume is better and fresher, et cetera. So a news co-op, it strikes me as a really interesting idea that could work really well. I'm on this because an old friend of mine is trying one in Massachusetts, and I'm on his advisory board, so I want this to work. But I don't have any single answer. This is my philosophy, and it's part of what I work on at Arizona State, is to convince students to be involved in the startup culture, to understand it and get involved in it. And what I'll tell students here tonight is I'm wildly jealous of them, even though it's a crazy time in media, but they're going to get to invent whatever is coming. And I want them to try absolutely everything, and we'll see what works.
Interesting. So again, you're speaking tonight at mm-hmm. On campus, right?
That's right.
The Reynolds Journalism Institute, mm-hmm. 7 o'clock, is that
right?
That's
right, yeah.
And that's open to the public?
The more the merrier.
Okay. Andrea, just any final thoughts in terms of what you'd like to see or what you think we need going forward?
Well, I think you know, that people are on the right track. They're listening to this program. I think more programs like this that really try and look, pull back the curtain and try and look at how we can be more strategic ourselves as voters, as citizens, in how we interact with our civic life, that is useful.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'd like to thank both of our guests today, Dan Gilmore, director of the Knight Center for Digital Media Entrepreneurship at Arizona State University, and Andrea Seabrook, former congressional reporter for NPR, now producer of the independent podcast and blog, Decode DC. We'd like to remind those of you enjoying this as a rebroadcast that Intersection takes place live for a full hour from 2 to 3 every Monday. You can join us each Monday afternoon by listening to KBIA or by going online to kbia.org and following the link for Intersection. There you'll be able to watch a video feed of the program, submit your questions and comments, and participate in an online chat with others in the audience. You'll also find a video archive of all of our past programs, including the full hour of today's conversation. Intersection is broadcast from the Reynolds Journalism Institute and is a project of RJI and KBIA. Today's program was produced by Raymond Tungekar. Travis McMillan is our technical director, with production assistance from Danny Madison. I'm Reuben Stern. Thanks for joining us. Have a great week.